Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. Do you know, 50 years ago today, I just found this out, Slaughter on 10th Avenue came out. Now, I don't know what that means to you, Mick Ronson's solo album.
No, I remember Mick Ronson's solo album, and it was I remember it being a very big deal, it being made to look like a very big deal at the time, but it didn't quite land, did it?
No, it didn't quite land, but I loved it, and it was a big influence on me, I think, as a guitar player. I particularly loved Slaughter on 10th Avenue, the sound
really,
of his guitar.
Quite complicated.
The sound of his guitar, I just thought, was so exquisite, so vocal. And I just wanted to mention, because I had that most amazing experience, you know, because he was one of the big influences in my life as a guitar player.
Yes, absolutely, yes.
That I went and found that guitar, you know,
that's
years
right,
later.
In Monte Carlo, wasn't it?
I did a documentary, and I think it was for Sky Arts, and it was about Mick Ronson, and part of the journey, as you say on TV, it was to go and find this guitar. And it's a bit of a disappointment when you see it, to be honest now, because I remember that guitar looking so sort of strange. It was a blonde front, but it was basically raw wood at the front. It was a Les Paul Custom Black that had been
stripped, hadn't it?
And then it had all got smashed up. But you know, at one point, he dropped it when he was playing with Ian the Hunter. Broke the neck off. It was all and it ended up in the back of Midgeur's wardrobe.
What?
Yes. It ended up in the back of Midgeur's wardrobe. You know, C.S. Lewis kind of vibe, you know. Go to the back of the wardrobe. There's Mick Ronson's guitar.
Narnia and Mick Ronson's guitar.
Anyway, Mick did it up in the end. So when you see it now, it's all a bit lackered and a bit, you know, it's not what you wanted. I digress because there was a...
Do you?
There was a...
I mean, do you? Wow.
Because... I just try...
I know, it's crazy.
Offering up news.
This is what we're all about.
Because I think the second electric guitar I ever bought was an Ibanez copy of a Gibson 175. Why did I buy that?
Because our guest today is synonymous with the ES-175, which is traditionally a jazz guitar.
Yeah. And it's also a Gibson, but I couldn't afford a Gibson. I got an Ibanez copy, a
blonde
one.
Not even without a case.
Nice. And for those who know, they know. And listen, I don't know how he could be an inspiration, because to play the kind of licks that Steve Howe played on that opening, the Yes album, you know, I mean, it's jazz, you're right. And it's phenomenal playing. But there was something it was something to achieve. I'm still hoping to achieve it.
What I'm really amazed at with Steve Howe is just what was happening before Yes, because he was everywhere for a few years. It's amazing. I'm really, really looking forward to getting stuck into that stuff. But also, because what's incredible with Steve is, because he's the one person you wouldn't think of to associate with kind of post-punk or punk or anything. And yet he was Keith Levine, and apparently this was all the way back in the time of Pill and everything, always cited Steve Howe as his greatest influence.
Well, see, there you are.
And of course the ES-175 was famously played by Geordie from Killing Joke.
Trevor Horn was a massive fan. And Steve, who's coming on any second, you can just wait, played the acoustic guitar solo on Welcome to the Pleasure Dome.
That's right.
Did you know that? But of course, also the best three Yes albums ever made, you know, the classic ones, the Yes album, Fragile, Close to the Edge, and more and more.
If you try and go through the Yes sort of discography, topography, or tales of topography, even, and just all the people come and go, it's like your head explodes.
Impossible.
It's like some Austro-Hungarian royal family.
Yes. And even Pete Frame couldn't have put this rock family tree together without
Pete Frame, that could have had an entire career doing Yes.
This wouldn't be a book, would it? It would be wallpaper if Pete Frame had to do Yes.
Exactly. Go one end of Versailles to the other.
Anyway, let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock On Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I've been sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
Get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock Haunters podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Steve! And beautiful clarity. Your Wi-Fi is obviously pumped up, full of steroids.
Listen, Starlink is the only link you need because this is running at 120 to 300 megabytes.
That's what I got.
Oh, you got it too.
That's what I got. I had no choice. But
I have no choice.
But it is amazing.
U2 and Zelensky has it as well, doesn't he?
I mean, that's right. It's what they use in Ukraine on the battlefield.
Oh, God.
Can I just add, we're making no money from Starlink right now, are we? Even though we're saying this. This is an ad. Steve, so lovely to finally get to talk to you.
This is brilliant. So great to have you. Sorry, and hello. I'm Guy.
Oh, hi, Guy. How you doing?
I'm Gary.
And Gary, how are you doing? You've got the headphones on. Oh, no, you both got headphones on. Sorry.
I was just saying that...
Yeah.
We were talking about guitar influences when we were kids, and... You know, for me, Mick Ronson was my first love.
Oh, yeah.
But then after a year or so, I bought an Ibanez copy of a 175 because of you.
Oh, yeah.
I could never play it like you. But I also want to add one other little thing there, where your influence entered my group, Spandau Ballet, all those years later.
Really?
But when I was sort of looking for fellow musicians in about 1975 to form a band with, 76... The reason I hooked on a guy called Steve Norman is because I walked into the music room and he was attempting to play the clap.
Oh, yeah. He was.
Or clap, as I should say.
Yeah.
But he did a pretty good job. Oh. And I thought, well, I'll hang with him.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah. If you can play clap, you must be okay, I guess, was a criteria. I think, yeah, we had that in the really early days. I mean, the very, very early days. If you could play Apache, you got the gig. You know what I mean? If you knew how to play that.
But well, that was always a thing around Yes, wasn't it? From the beginning, I remember Bill Bruford saying there was this terrible competitiveness about playing. And there was this worry that if there was anyone sort of down the street who could play a bit better than you, then you'd be out.
Yeah, there was a sort of almost orchestral rule as well. Oh, that guy, you know, the second bass is screwing up, change him. That kind of ruthless. But I mean, yeah, in a band like Yes, there was a kind of flow of musicians, you know, a lot of them keyboard players, but there was a lot of flow of musicians coming in and out, and some of it was really unfortunate, and we just had to deal with what we were presented with. You know, here's the situation, get on with it. But you know, other times it was it's like when Jeff and Trevor joined us for drama. That was a kind of whole reinvention again of 70s Yes, and so there were lots of pluses anyway.
Well, you've been in Yes the longest now. Now that you know Alan, rest in peace, has gone, and you are the longest member. But do you think, just saying that your particular sound and your style and who you are then is the hinge for it all, that and regardless of how many musicians are coming in and going, it's about you now, Steve, really.
Well, to some extent, listen, I noticed something I'd written. I think I must have been looking at a scrapbook or a quote book or something, but I know I said when I joined Yes that Peter Banks was a good guitarist, and I had somewhere to take it from, you know what I mean? I had a starting point. And somebody once accused me of copying him. And I said, look, I was already like psychedelic out, you know, I was into my thing, you know, and I was looking for a band where I was as free as a bird, you know, I didn't want restrictions. And so Yes was offered me that whole kind of palette. But certainly my sound has become, you know, somewhat synonymous with it. You know, Trevor Rabin did the 80s. And basically, you know, there was a shift back to a more, you know, 70s desire for the sound. And, of course, you know, that music stood up incredibly well. But we love making new music, but, you know, it's also great to be able to play, you know, and pick and choose what we play from the great...
Because as soon as you came into the band on Yours Is No Disgrace, and we'll go back to the beginning and we'll come back to Yes, I'm sure, but just say... No. you are all over that intro, playing possibly every style of guitar that you can you had in your locker.
Yeah, I guess I did throw everything into Yes, you know, because I hadn't nowhere else to put it, really. And I'd been hoping that a band of equal musicianship capabilities as me could do something. And yeah, I had a lot of tunes up my sleeve. You know, I already had parts of Close to the Edge written, Tales from Topographic Oceans. Some of that was, you know, in the 69 period when I was using one band and looking for the next band. You know, I wrote quite a lot of music, and some of it became, you know, part of Yes. So, yeah, the guitar, the way I was different from a lot of guys, I guess, was I wasn't really into a big trebly thing. I like warm sounds, and I like clean sounds, you know, and this was kind of like, but I had to marry it or mix it, if you like, with power. And Yours in Notice Grace is a great example. Yeah, I'm all over the intro, and the theme starts up, and then I'm over the theme, and then the vocals start up, and then I get in. And when I do that solo with the touch of wah, and that's a multi-mood solo. You know, it starts with the stabs and all that dead and clicking on the guitar and things, quite rock and roll. But once it starts moving, it goes to different places, you know. And I remember Bill saying to me after I'd done that solo, I wish I'd known all the things you're going to play, because I might have played something else. But basically, I designed that solo after the backing track was written. So, you know, I had those structures, the do-do-do-do, and all that stuff. I had all that kind of like just looking for a home, you know, and suddenly Yes was the home. Yeah. So much of my guitar work, like it was with Worm and, you know, Seen on Good People, you know, it was a lovely opening. I'll never thank the guys enough.
Because of course, because when you come into Yes, Steve, all the stuff you're doing before, because this is what I'm going to do, you've got that period that's, it's like 3 years before Yes, where you're everywhere. Mm-hmm. You are everywhere. It's fantastic. Lots of stuff. But then, I said, but your sound, even before Yes, you were kind of very much ahead of the pack. A lot of people were still, like you said, trebly and twangy and everything. Yeah. It's like you and Jeff Beck were kind of just that bit in front of everyone else.
It seemed to me. I think it was the influences, you know. Although I like, you know, Hank Marvin, Duane Eddy, all the original guys, I got into Tal Farlow and Wes Montgomery big time because I saw him. And basically the styles I picked up, but then I heard Chet Atkins and that was it. It was like, ding. But I want to tell you a little story, because although Chet has always been the guy I've always said.
Shit Hopkins, as David Gilmour always called him.
Really? Hopkins. That's good.
Shit Hopkins.
Yeah. But you see, the really nifty thing was, it took me years to realise, in fact, Les Paul had been a much greater influence on me, because that started when I was about 8 years old, when my parents had the 78s, and they were buying, like, you know, How High the Moon and The World is Waiting for the Sunrise. Mm-hmm. And I heard all this guitar, and I just absorbed it, you know. So when I look back later, I realized that, yeah, Les Paul, you know, I met him a few times. He was a character. And basically, he was a huge influence before I even got to Chet. But once I heard Chet, yeah, I mean, I love this guy, you know, and I adopted that style. Like you say, on the Yes album, I'm playing Clap, I'm playing Yours and Yours Grace, I'm playing Worm. You know, there's a lot of variety, and that's what I think I learned from both of those guys.
You know, your voice is quite comforting for me, because that accent, I recognise so much from North London, because I was born and brought up on the Essex Road,
right,
not that far from the Holloway Road where you grew up. And Rod Stewart was also from there.
Was he really? I didn't know that. Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, his parents had a tobacconist just off the off of the Holloway Road.
Oh, really? Oh, I might have gone in there when I was underage. But we were all like, Nag, did you know the Nag's Head then? Because that was like a place in Holloway that was like the centre point. I'll meet you at Nag's Head.
Of course. You know, the Nag's Head is very famous. But I just, you know, growing up then in that Islington world, there seems to be elements of all this music coming into your life. Was this all through your parents?
Well, those initial things were, and I found that any kind of music got me physically jumping around.
Was he musical, your dad?
He did like music, yeah, and he did his painting. He was a master chef. He was a cordon bleu chef. And basically, he had some artistic skills, and he did like music, and basically, you know, more like band music, and not strictly jazz or anything, but as I had an older brother who liked jazz, and then my other young brother that was not as old but still older than me, he was really big on jazz. So I had those influences floating around all the time. I couldn't really avoid them. But Islington, the strange thing is that it's couldn't really find what I wanted in Islington. I had to go to Tottenham. So part of my upbringing was as soon as I learned to play the guitar and I was looking for somewhere to play, I met a guy in Tottenham.
That's funny because you're kind of moving further out.
That's right.
Yeah. Usually with London, you assume you go further out.
Of course, when it, a bit later on, it became the epicentre with pubs like the Hope and Anchor, of course, which weren't, I don't think, existed in the 60s.
Yeah.
So what was that? Well, first of all, did you have a guitar by the time you moved to Tottenham, as it were?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm thinking that, well, I got a guitar when I was 12, you know, after wanting one for a couple of years, and it was a cello. I picked it out myself. It was a cello guitar. I wasn't going to get a Spanish guitar or an electric guitar. I had to get a cello guitar.
That was my first guitar, was actually. Terror. Could hardly press the strings down. They were so high up.
I was vaguely interested in dance band guitar because I bought a book called Eric Kershaw's Dance Band Chords, and that was that nobody was playing these chords. I thought, I don't hear these chords. But then, of course, they were in jazz a lot. And I wanted to learn a bit more about the.
So it wasn't Burt Whedon. You weren't Burt Whedon.
Well, he was never very impressive because he was always too straight. You know, he was always a bit on. But I, you know, the stories. Yeah, I mean, he was the only guitarist I knew whose merchandising was homemade marmalade. Did you know that?
Eating a day.
So yeah, he was not. He was more mums and dads. You know, he was the middle of the road guitarist. You know. But yeah. So one of the reasons I got a 175 was because, well, Wes Montgomery was seen with one and Jim Hall and lots of jazz guitar players. Yeah,
Joe Pass
played a 175. Right. Well spotted. And also an English guitarist called Judd Proctor. He played a 175. Now, he made a fascinating instrumental called Nola, which was very fast. You know, and I had to learn this, you know, by slowing it down to 33, of course. And so the 175, well, that came later when I was 16. So when I was 12, I got the cello. But then within 2 years, I had electric guitar. It was a Gaiatone. I think it's called LG50 or something, or sometimes called an Antoria. A little Japanese guitar, very small body with kind of big pickups. In fact, Hank Marvin was playing one of these before he got the Strat, you know, with the infamous story that it was written Bruce Welch. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hank's been on the show, Bruce Welch has been on the show.
We've had them both on. Yeah, we've had both sides.
So that little guitar was great fun. I got a Burns Jazz for a little while, which was...
Which the Shadows played as well, right, Burns?
Yeah, with the Shads. But of course, the Shads were quite synonymous with the Fender sound. I couldn't really grapple with Fenders at the time. But I was moving along. And then when I was 17, I said to my mum and dad, you know, if I'm going to do this for real, like, I need a great guitar. You know, I really need a good guitar. So when I said it was 200 guineas, they were like, what? I said, well, like, if you put the deposit down, you know, I'll pay the regular monthly.
God, in those days, that's a... Wow.
200 guineas.
200 quid? I mean, guineas.
They were expensive.
It's a house.
And I had to order it. It came in 2 months later. So I got that guitar. That seemed to be like it, you know, with me. That it was like, I've come home. This is the guitar, you know. And it turned out to be right. That even though I switched endlessly across different Gibson guitars every album during the 70s, eventually going somewhere in the middle to Fender Telecasters, And basically, I wanted to explore what the guitar could do, looking for a sound, but I kind of had it. You know? I already had it. I was looking around. But wherever I went, I seemed to make some sort of recognisable sound, even on acoustic. And that was a great, great breakthrough for me with Roundabout, was that I thought at the beginning, wait, is anybody going to know that's me playing? But, you know, in a way, the acoustic became a big part of my approach to music.
Definitely.
Oh, that harmonic riff, I worked that out. Yeah. So that was early doors. That was such a brilliant opening.
Yeah.
But what you've not mentioned is sort of what we normally hear from people on this show is the Beatles. Yeah. But that was still important to you. I mean, you were never after the dirty rock sound of P Pete Townsend or...
Not really. I realised that that was quite electrifying, you know, quite electric, you know, in its qualities. But, you know, there was certainly, when the Beatles came around, that was kind of it for a while. They were the biggest thing in my life until Bob Dylan, you know, until I got freewheeling. So, you know, the Beatles kicked it into gear, and I've got just total 100% respect for everything they did. I mean, that's the best band ever that's been around. And I can't, you know, there's no time when they're not somewhere near me or have some part of what I do. And I love all that dearly.
To jump ahead slightly, weren't you recording in Abbey Road when they were doing Sgt. Pepper's at the same time?
That's right. Tomorrow we're in there. I did a reissue of the Tomorrow album. It's now called...
Oh, yeah, I tried to find that, by the way, because I could only find the 1999 remaster.
No, don't buy that, please. This is a different world. I did a kind of revolver on that where I took it. Didn't want to alter it too much, but I could see where we could improve things, and also the running order, and some of the tracks went out and some others came in. So basically the sound that they made on all those records and was just so amazing that I couldn't really, you know. But gradually the psychedelic, I mean, listen, 67 was the big year, you know, when Sgt. Pepper and Psychedelia and the Byrds, for instance, that was another crucial band with me and Keith West. I mean, we just used to listen to how the Byrds did things and go, oh, we want to do it like that, you know. So that's why we did their song Why on our record. But basically, there was so much to absorb. You know, the Beatles kicked off a whole kind of phenomenon. And the Big Three were another band I liked. You know, Brian Griffiths was a great guitarist, you know, like Mick Green in The Pirates. So there was this kind of breed of great guitarists who, it's a kind of history, you know, from singers. Singers usually, I mean, in a band like, you know, Led Zeppelin, you know, the singer and the guitarist, if they get on and they write music or they play well together, it goes on. But that's been going on for years, you know, since Rick Nelson got, you know, James Burton, since Elvis Presley had Scotty Moore. There's a whole thread
Mick and Keith
of stories of singers with guitarists. And that's where I always dreamed I would be. I'd be standing there like this and there was a singer. You know, that was my kind of fantasy of where I was heading as a young musician.
Your first calling card, I mean, because you was like the generation before, you worked with Joe Meek.
Yeah.
I'm surprised you're not called Steve Gorgeous or something, or Steve X. You know, I guess he renamed all his artists, didn't he?
Oh, yes, he did. That's right. I don't know whether he had
Steve
a name.
Steve Proud.
He did approach me a few times. And
Steve Unbreakable.
Yeah, he got a little kind of like talkative about things. And I said, well, listen, Joe, I've got to go and see my girlfriend down in Tottenham. But basically, he it was a great introduction to production, because I believe that Les Paul, in fact, is the greatest producer.
Well, he invented multi-tracking, didn't he?
I mean, but if you listen to the records he made, you think that how he made them, they're incredible. But later on, of course, you know, the influence of his work, you know, when then, you know, only Chet Atkins producing like the Everly Brothers and things like that. But Joe believed, I think you might know this, that he was being, his ideas were being stolen by Phil, what was his name? Phil Spector.
Right?
It was a bit the other way around, really. But anyway, there was maybe some truth in it, you know, that Spector had heard something.
This is really close to home for you, because this is Holloway. His studio was in Holloway, wasn't it?
I fell out of bed and went into his studio. You know, we went in for an audition because the bass player, you know, Tottenham bass player, his mum had the, you know, galls to approach, write to him or something. My son's in a great band. They're called the Syndicates. You ought to see him. So he invited us in. We lugged the equipment up the stairs and played.
While she was off doing her shopping, she just popped in a little note to Joe Meek.
He liked her.
The Syndicates. That's so great.
Funny, pathetic, great but also. Name. But yeah, he liked us, and you know, he did Maybelline, you know, pretty good job on that. And he sped up the B side a little bit, and you know, he was very strange to work with, I've got to say. You know, and he sometimes fried, you know, and he'd say like, "You guys are terrible. I'm going out for an hour. When I come back, if you're not any good, you're out." You know, so we'd practice for an hour and he'd come back. So that's all right. Okay, carry on.
But you had the chops, Steve. You know, listening back to those early records, it's still very obviously you.
I was getting so many influences, you know, particularly jazz. You know, in that early thing, my mind was thinking, oh, yeah, all this rock and roll, great, but, you know, listen to the... But that was because when you heard Wes Montgomery, you just didn't know what the hell he was doing. I mean, how can you play a guitar that good, you know? You know, as a beginner, you're kind of like stumbling with just like playing the tune. So, yeah, I was determined to learn.
Was there classical in there as well for you? Because that comes out so much in your Yes stuff.
That came in very subtly because after 67, I lived with my brother Phil for a while, and he was in the classical. And I heard, you know, something like Vivaldi's Four Seasons, or it might have been the flute concertos, actually. But anyway, I heard some Vivaldi, and I thought, I like this guy. You know, I like the rhythm so much, rhythm and life and excitement in this music. Balancing all these different musical enjoyments is easy. I just go with the flow, you know. I'll just surprise myself, think, I'll listen to this, or I'll do that, or I hear that. So a lot of music just kind of flows around the world now, doesn't it? You don't have to be like looking for it before you hear it.
Let's get to tomorrow, because you are, I mean, this, you're one of the key, you're one of the three bands, basically. There's Pink Floyd, Soft Machine, and Tomorrow. You're a key player in that original UFO psychedelic scene. Which is an amazing place to be.
Yeah, it was. Surely. It was an amazing place to be, but, you know, what was going on there? We were fumbling around a bit in the studio, making the album. It came out late, you know. But when we released My White Bicycle as a single, I mean, it went great, you know. It was edging that up the charts, and it looked like tomorrow we're going to be like, hey, you know, this is going to be something. But it kind of... didn't quite, you know, but it was ever popular live. But yeah,
but Joe Boyd, you must have met Joe, who run the UFO Club, and he and then he asked you to come on. I mean, was it early days? Was did you support Pink Floyd at one point? I'm not sure.
Well, no, you were asked. It didn't happen, but you were asked to stand in for Sid one night. Weren't
That's
you?
Right, and it was going to be at the UFO. So that was an exciting moment for me. But then suddenly, at the last minute, he came in the door. So I don't know what it would have been. It would have been a blindingly amazing improvisation. But I was going to mention that improvisation is everything to me. You know, I was so lucky that I could sit down and just noodle on a guitar. Other people saying, have you done, did you learn to do scales? I said, no, I don't bother with scales. But of course I did later on. But at first I was just noodling all the time. As soon as I could play something, I played imaginary things, you know what I mean? So that's been part of why I write music altogether, because without improvisation, I would never tune.
But let's just go back into that club, because that club is so important. And, you know, obviously, I don't know if you know, but Guy and I play with Nick Mason. We do
the
Floyd stuff. So it's dear to us as well. But what was that atmosphere like? Was there a sense of for youth culture that it was now your turn. The Beatles and the Beat Groups had gone, and it was your turn.
Kind of thing, but also it was like the centre of the universe of musical, you know, happenings, you know, because happenings were kind of new, you know. I mean, before you just played a gig and people sat there, you know, but the happenings, they were really new. And going somewhere where it's all kind of happening, it's all sounds a bit that's like a cliche, but like there's, you know, there's stuff on the wall, there's music going, there's, I don't know, it was just like a jungle of creative minds, not all of them just music, but, you know, dance. And I really can't describe it, but it was a centre for being out of it together and having a good time, you know. And it was all just barely legal. So you could go there and sort of have such a wild time. I mean, one night we were... there. I mean, I don't know who opened for who, but people just played there. And the Crazy World of Arthur Brown, he set the stage on fire with, you know, fire. Of course, the place was. And of course, this is where it's true that Jimi Hendrix joined Tomorrow on the bass and improvised with us for about 10 minutes.
So was he in the club? Was he in the club?
Yeah, he was. That was at Blazes. Sorry, I must stick to the rules. That was the truth. That was at Blazes.
Rules? The truth.
Sort of like after, you know, after everybody had played and, you know, people went to this club. And I even saw Joni Mitchell singing on her own there before she was even known.
So where was Blazes? Where was Blazes?
Sorry?
Where was Blazes?
So Blazes, yeah, this was this smart little club near Oxford Street. I'm surprised you didn't hear about it. You're putting the ears on me now. But yeah, the speaking.
Blazes, yeah, no, no,
yeah, you know that name.
I'm going to say I knew it, of course,
as one of those, right. You know, like Bag of Nails or all those.
Yeah, some remarkable people work.
And you were playing there, and you got up and jammed, and Jimmy grabbed the bass.
Well, yeah, you know, I'm thinking whether it was Blazes or the UFO. You know, I think it was the UFO.
Okay, we'll have that.
It was much
yeah, we'll definitely have that. I'm amazed that this isn't about a document.
I think it is mentioned. I
mean, let's face it, everyone was off their head.
Yeah, it is mentioned in my book, and I have mentioned it in a few interviews. So it might come back to me which ones.
And had you heard him as a guitar player?
Oh, of course, yeah. In fact, you know, the Tomorrow were lucky enough to be... No, okay, Blazes. We were lucky enough to be the resident band in Blazes. We played there every Thursday. And Jimi Hendrix came there, and he played... That was one of his... first shows in the club called Blazes. If you look up his history, you will see it's either that was the second or it was the first show he ever did in the UK. And basically, you know, he showed up and nobody knew what he was doing. I mean, he was just amazing. You know, this huge guy up there with a strap around the wrong way. And it all looked wrong, but it all sounded right. And actually, he came off stage and sat down with us on the table, and there was Twink and Junior. And, you know, the band stayed. We were always hanging out together. And he said, I hear you're the opening band or something. So he was so kind. Of course, we ran into him a few times, you know, after that opening for him, like at the big show, the Christmas on Earth concerts. And, you know, like you said, Tomorrow, you were big in Tomorrow Up, and it's true. We were really well respected, and it was a great time to be part of that whole, you know, style.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And you were going to maybe be the band in Blow Up.
Oh, yes.
The story about the guitar was made. It was actually a copy of yours.
Instead of the
album. Yeah, that's right. We had the gig first, and then we were ousted because obviously the Yardbirds had a name. But they didn't they didn't get new models of Jeff's guitar or whatever it was. They didn't get a Strat. So he had to break a 175 cardboard copy or something like. I mean, that's as much as I know. It does happen. Yeah, you hardly see him, but he starts breaking his guitar, and it's not his guitar.
And of course, the whole thing was a mistake, wasn't it? Because the whole reason that scene was written because it was meant to be the Hood.
It's a kind of horrible mix-up. I don't know where.
But while we're on the movie tip, Smashing Time. I'd love to. That looks so great. I mean, it just looks dreadful, but so fantastic.
You are on IMDb as being in Smashing Time, Steve. And having...
I don't know how we got that, you know. But the Snarks. Right. I should add that to my list of 10 bands I've been in. I've also been in the Snarks. Wait for it.
It sounds like something that you'd see in Private
Eye. There's a guy,
Eye,
I think. Yeah, yeah, it does. Because I think there's a guy that really deserves a name check, and that's Lord Anthony Rufus Isaacs. And I think he's still around. And basically, he was a guy who had all the connections where we were playing Dead Parties, and, you know, these very smart players played loads of money. And so basically, I think he had an in with films or something. And the next thing we knew, we were kind of, you know, part of the story. You know, the Snarks were this band that were doing it. Yeah, but there's only a couple of lines. I think I say something like, let's have them or let's get them or something like that. There's not very much dialogue.
Before we move away from Tomorrow, there's a couple of other things, because I did hear...
Is there, though? Is there?
There is.
No, I'm done.
There's There's the day before tomorrow. Anyway, but no, it's when you, I mentioned you were recording in Abbey Road when the Beatles were there doing Sgt. Pepper's. There is this story, I'm sure it's apocryphal, that you needed a policeman's whistle and you went out onto the street looking for a copper.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, working with Mark Wirtz was really great fun. I mean, he was a really good producer for us because, you know, he let us do what the hell we like mainly. But, you know, he had some tricks, you know, backwards stuff, and he was up to speed. So, yeah, we were doing, the song My White Bicycle and needed a whistle. So we said, how do we get a policeman's whistle? You know, and next thing, somebody was outside looking for the policeman. Of course, they were only too happy to come in for 5 minutes. And, everything was concealed and airsprayed. The guy comes in and, do it here. We'll give you a cue. And the policeman screams, and I can't hear it. And he blows the whistle.
Yeah. And he blew his whistle.
Yeah, so
that is
genuine amazing. Police whistle.
Did Hapsash and the Colour Coat design a poster? Is there a tomorrow poster?
Yeah, yeah.
What a thing, Steve, that you have had the Nigel Weymouth, Michael English, Hapsash design and Roger Dean in your life.
So lucky. And I'm spoiled, absolutely rotten because, you know, both are great. I mean, Roger's been wonderful all over these years. But those guys and that whole thing with Granny Takes a Trip, you know, and how we, you know, 200 pound shirts and things. Or maybe they weren't quite so expensive as that, but they, you know, it was worth having the right clothes, that was for sure. And if you had a few stars on your forehead, didn't hurt either. I've been very lucky with design and photographers too. You know, a guy called Mickey Slingsby was an art photographer that took a lot of pictures of me over my career. But other great guys, you know, Aerosmith, you know, some of the top photographers filmed Yes and other bands I've been in. And a guy called Mike Russell, in fact, took some great pictures, GTR and other things. So I've seen how photography is so important, you know, and I enjoy it too. I take a few pictures. I put them in my album series, Homebrew. If it's a guy pushing a pram across a zebra crossing, I got it. You know, I want that, you know.
It's funny, though, because I don't know about you, Guy. I mean, one of the things I loved about those early Yes albums was the fact that it wasn't necessarily a picture, apart from on the Yes album, obviously, there was. Mm. But it was this fantasy world that was somehow...
Oh, yeah. No, it was...
Where, you know, the music was coming from. It was coming from those floating islands.
I know. It's just uncanny how well Roger's work not only worked perfectly on Fragile, but then with the awful exceptions of when he wasn't invited, all the other times he came up with sensational things. I mean, there's one album, I'm not going to mention what it was, but later on he did an album and I said to him, it's better than the music. There was one album that didn't work out so well. So Roger's been, sustaining power, you know, it's really amazing how.
Well, I think it's got the most. It's probably the most symbiotic relationship of kind of artists. Yeah. It's basically Yes and Roger Dean, yes. Pink Floyd and Hypnosis are the two most.
Yeah. Right. Even though, I mean, every band was jumping on the bandwagon after that, weren't they? I mean, from Giant to, I mean, like, you know, people were all wanted Roger Dean to make those records somehow. They all felt like a bit of a rip-off because it was Yes, it belonged to Yes.
Yeah. Well, it did, but look at the shot I had when he did Asia, because Asia 2 had...
The dragon.
Yeah, the dragon. It had the logo with this. You see, Roger was up to his tricks again, and he cast the magic a little bit on Asia for a while, and some of that Asia stuff has lasted many, many years, you know. And so he did Anson Brewer Wakeman. He happened to do a lot of bands that I was in. He's done some solo albums of mine as well, including Turbulence.
Because, while we're on him, we'll stay on him. Because, even though we're not talking about you in Yes yet, but it sees that logo, that bubble writing of Yes, all joining up.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know about you, Guy, but I mean, you're a couple of years younger than me, but every kid in my class, every bloke in my class.
Oh, true. I did that on an exercise book.
Did it? You knew how to do
it. Of course,
that.
It was the same, because of course he did the Virgin logo, didn't he?
Yes.
Which is the same sort of thing, that original Virgin logo.
Yeah, he did quite a few.
How were you introduced to him?
We were, it's kind of funny story. We'd done the Yes album, blah, blah, blah. We were being managed by a guy. And he at the time had a job at Hemda, which became, you know, a big, this was in like very early 70s. So he was working at Hemda. Somehow, it's a fantastic crossroads. And here's Yes sitting in this Mayfair office, you know, and it's all kind of grappling to get food on the table. And somebody in a Mayfair office with these guys, they're also doing so well, great. And then suddenly, through the management or Hemdale, you know, we put the feelers out and this guy called Roger Dean comes in and shows us some stuff and we were instantly, you know, taken to it. And so he went off and designed the Fragile Sleeve based on that. And
because if you put your guitar and John Anderson's lyrics into an AI machine, it would have come up with Roger Dean's front covers, wouldn't it?
But is there a thing that like, luckily you were the guys that he came to see. He could have gone to see someone else, and then, you know, everyone's story would be different.
You see, some people wanted, and I think this is what Hypnosis did for Floyd, they'd come along with like six pictures and you pick one, you know, one of them. But what Roger did was try and get a feel for the album and then go away and do one, you know. So it was very much, you know, it felt like it was a very personalised process. And that's true of all the albums. I mean, particularly, you know, not particularly anything. It's true of all the albums. Tales from Topographic Oceans, you know, that's another exceptional thing. But I'll give Roger every bit of credit. He generally comes up with a concept.
It's brilliant that you had someone with a very sort of strong visual identity to present to you, because of you had all these competing, perhaps very strong personalities in the band.
Certainly, we had an unusual, I think, you know, you needed a sort of special ear to like Yes, you know, that was obvious because we didn't do singles, you know, we weren't getting played like the regular bands. We were carving a much more progressive rock approach to things, which was everything's a catalogue piece and we're going to make more records and we're going to do more tours. So we're just going to keep revolving. And Yes is always was and always will be fundamentally a fairly hard-working band, you know. We haven't got to the point, nor do we really want to, where, you know, everybody says, oh, we're kind of loaded, let's call it quits. we're kind of like, we've got commitments, and they're partly to carry on the music that, you know, the ones that we've lost started as well, and live up, you know, and live up to the idea of what Yes music is, we hope.
You mentioned prog rock and having no singles. There must have been something that pushed that created that genre before Yes. And I know that one of the bands that often gets cited is The Nice with Keith Emerson. You auditioned, didn't you?
Here's another quick story. Yeah, that's right, I did. I would have loved to have done that. I mean, I got the job. But the next day I had, you know, palpitations on what the consequences for the people I was working with were going to be if I quit, you know. And I've never put...
Who were you with at that point?
I was with this group, Bodust, you know, and...
which came after
We were not getting very far.
With an album that never came out, right? Your album, but you released the album yourself.
That's right. 10 years later, I released it. But basically, that was a bit of a nightmare to come out of that and go into, you know, the next phase, which was to be something memorable.
Oh, hang on, but talking of which, while we're back there, because, you're playing with Ronnie Wood.
That's right.
And Ainsley Dunbar.
Well, yeah, Keith West got some solo tracks together. I mean, you know, it was a great time. There was a lot of roaming and gloaming going on with...
So I'm saying you were everywhere, man. You were
just casually, yeah. I mean, also, I was quite a lot in my studios doing sessions, you know, for the rate. But basically, that was also fun because Mark Works took me under his wing. I suppose he took me under his wing and then he produced Tomorrow because, you know, we got on so well and he thought, you know, he'd like to produce Tomorrow. I think we strayed off the question, though. Did we left a question unanswered there? Is any...
Where was The Nice?
Oh, yeah.
I think The Nice was the...
I would have loved to have done that, and I got the job successfully. As I say, I got palpitations about, you know, letting a whole load of people down, and I wouldn't recommend that. That's not a very career-conscious decision.
Was that before Five Bridges or after?
I can't... Well, it was anything after Dave Lift's not being there would be when...
Right, okay.
So...
Oh, right, because he went off with... to work with King Crimson, right?
did, actually, or whether he was in a clear state of mind to do anything, because I thought the reason I was coming in was that David List had slightly lost it and that, you know, he wasn't working so well with the guy. I don't know what the story is. I can't remember. It's a long time ago. But, yeah, there's lots of those little moments when you think, oh, that could have gone this way. Well, I love playing with Keith, I must say. But there were other reasons, too, a little bit of concern about the way he was set up with a guy, you know, walked in the pub and pulled out money. And I'd never seen that before, really. There was a sort of lack of discretion, I feel, business discretion, you know. But anyway, I was in a different camp, if you like. I wasn't in the camps, you know, like I...
It could have been... Emerson, Howe and Palmer.
That's right. On the roll. Goodness, yeah.
So were you aware of Yes as a band before you ended up being auditioning?
Just marginally, yeah. I mean, I'd heard about the band and I heard they were very good. So I hadn't heard the music, but I'd heard about the reputation. So when the guys, you know, when Chris Gordon, I went and played with the guys in Barnes, it was just amazing. I mean, I walked in, plugged in. They said, yeah, well, we'll do this song. It's got G and it goes to A or something or the other. We messed around with some songs. And I thought they were great. You know, I really thought, hang on, this is really good. I better not.
So who's in the room? Who's in the room?
Bill Bruford's on drums. Chris Bill, on bass. And John's sitting there with a microphone. And Tony Kaye's on Hammond. Yeah. And where he's always comfortable and he plays it great. You know, he's a great player. So basically, that band was really exciting just to come in.
Because they had their own psychedelic band previous to that, which I think has still got the best name in psychedelia, which is Mabel Greer's Toy Shop.
Somebody did refer to that as possibly the tweeest psychedelic group name ever. But it is. That's right. That's where Chris and Peter Banks had been, I believe, together. And
But it was Chris. Was Chris the driving force when you turned up that day?
Well, I mean, to me, I related more to John when I met them both. You know, and John and I think I even went back to John's flat after this in Queensgate or something. He lived there with his wife, and we talked about. I think there was the place where we talked before that. So I really only talked to John about joining the band, if you like. But at the rehearsal, it was obviously interactive, and you know they felt I was pretty good. And
their style, didn't you? Really, they weren't. Those first two albums don't sound like the Yes we now know on the Yes album. Mm-hmm. And once you joined,
yeah. Well, I mean, in a way, I don't think I've thought this before, but I would look back, when I've looked back with you kind of thing, like I think there's a lot more order. In other words, there's not overflowing amounts of something that kind of, some of the arranging or some of the mixing, you know, on Time in a Word, left it a little bit like it was a bit of a struggle. There was always this struggle going on in the sound. I think with Eddie Offord stepping up to the plate and co-producing the Yes album with us gave us all the chance to put input, but also we had a guy who was pretty clever at doing what he was doing, you know, and possibly a bit of ahead of his time. So that all helped tremendously.
But who was guiding the way, do you think, out there as far as being able to make songs that were in multiple timings, key signatures, that were longer than a normal single? Was it Fripp? Was it King Crimson? Who gave you the validation, the license to do that?
There was a very good balance between John, who didn't really play a lot of chords, didn't really have a big technique, but he could strum away and get some melody going. But what he was also very, very good at encouraging and allowing, and it was the instinct of the band that everybody put stuff in, you know, not so much like another song, but like if you had something, you'd have to decide how you're going to play that and make it sound great, you know. So it wasn't just a question of, like, going to play the roots and Bill's going to stay in 4/4. That was out, you know, that wasn't allowed. So nobody could float or just drift along, only for a while, you know, while you're finding your parts. And of course, some of the best parts came from Chris, but they took a long time. So everybody had plenty of time to get your parts together while Chris was developing, you know, how to finesse his part. Or he'd overdub it or overdub some of it after we recorded it. But all that rehearsing was good. You know, we'd record things. It always sounded like, fortunately, 100% better when we, like, worked on it in the studio. You know, we take it in and say that sounds horrible. Because
some of it, you would literally assemble like sweets, wouldn't you? Wouldn't it just be like one piece at a time?
Oh, well, that we did record like that, but usually we had to go in with a demo that had most of the song, maybe not all of it, but most of the song, and it ran through, even if it was edited. But yeah, when we got in there, we usually found, because of the size of the tracks, of course, we'd only record one section, if we were lucky, a day, you know, and that section might be 3 minutes, or it might be 5 minutes, or it might be 2 minutes. So it just depends how we were going to do it. And as we went through the Yes album, and it really is interesting, because when we got to Your Move, I've Seen All Good People, you know, somewhere we said, well, you know, don't let's play this. It's not going to work. So we created the loop, you know, that goes boop, 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 boop. That's all it did. Boop, boop, kept going boop, boop. I think I had a note on it. Chris had an E as well. Boop, boop. So basically, there it was. And I went out and, you know, we've agreed how many of what we'd have, because obviously you couldn't edit this later, you know, like you do today. Oh, we'll have an extra verse. Oh, great, throw it in. No, this had to be like, you had to play it, and every verse was different. So I'd go out there and I demoed the whole song, if you like. Well, not demo, but I mastered the Portuguese guitar all the way through it. And that was the structure. Agreed, you know, well, I didn't do it on my own, but it was all agreed. We'd have three of these, two of them, and half a dozen of them, you know. And then I had the chance to, you know, do any fiddly bits, I'd do it. And then maybe I'd track it. And then that would quit, you know, then we'd add stuff. And so it was lovely that, yes, even in that early stage, we're actually taking on a production, nothing to do with playing. It had all to do with prepared musical ideas, going into effect to create space and quality of sound, you know, where that Portuguese guitar is properly recorded. You know, nobody's hammering away in the background with the cymbal. You know, everything was separate. The Roundabout and Fragile really epitomizes that even more. When you got to that album, I mean, it's so tight, you know, for its time, you know, Chris and Bill, you know, on Roundabout, and the acoustic guitars I put on, the harmonics. I mean, that was a really good way to start it. You know, we didn't have any grunge. We didn't have anything to take out. We didn't have any mistakes, you know, that anybody did. It was all, I think that's what it was. It was preparation and structure and invention, because we never said, let's do it better.
You weren't overdubbing, were you? You were doing a guitar solo on your own.
I was overdubbing was the big, I mean, I got some nice rhythm guitars at times, which you'll hear. Like maybe Journey, ding, ding, ding. That's when the original guitar. But all the other verses and all the other stuff were carefully worked out, you know, afterwards with the same guitars, you know, same amp. And things like that. But basically,
you've always, from very early on, you were very, very involved and kind of interested in the actual recording process of the guitar, weren't you?
Yeah, that's right. I always felt that, you know, Kenny Burrell was a great example, jazz guitarist, who I believed he always saw his guitar through. And I used to recommend this. Don't just play and walk away, go out and have a beer. You know, watch how that guitar, where's the position? What's the EQ? What's the reverb? You know, can we put some delays on it? You know, what do you want to do with that? Because you just recorded it. Don't leave it to somebody else who maybe thinks, oh, you know, thinks.
That's right. A guitar's for life, not just for Christmas, right?
That's absolutely right. Yeah. So, yeah, I like that craftsmanship. And it's now, you know, I'm doing more production than I've ever done. But I've, you know, produced my own solo albums. But I've been part of the team that's produced Yes from day one, you know. But
I think, you know, what I get talking to you is actually, you know, we all think about prog rock coming from, I just, as I said earlier, from bands like Keith Emerson and The Nice, but actually psychedelia was so important, wasn't it? I mean, those early Pink Floyd albums, you know, with Interstellar Overdrive and Source for the Secrets, what they were doing.
Yeah, Gary, you're saying it was actually, I'm sorry, this just to reiterate your point, you carry on afterwards, it's just that actually that long form, free form sort of prog structure comes from those Pink Floyd jams at the UFO Club, I would have thought.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, I said earlier, impro is everything. And I mean, you know, I'm getting the memories of how important, you know, like a good guitar break is to me. You know, we do Siberian Kutru, and it's a great song. You know, it's complex. It's got lots of changing rhythm. There's lots of textures and sound. And then I go, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I start jamming, you know, and that's okay. Leave me with this for a few rounds, guys.
Great.
You know, I like cooking up something on the guitar, and that's a guitar break, you know. And
we had Rick Wakeman on the show as well, and obviously what a huge personality to come in. But you already knew Rick, didn't you? Didn't you do some sessions? Didn't you do Lou Reed with him before?
No, that was done up when we were doing Topographic Ocean.
Oh, so it was. But what a personality to come in. I mean, very different from Tony Kaye and all the Moog stuff. Did you feel that enhanced what you did? Or was there, were you sort of, you know, trying to find your own space now Rick had come in?
No, it was the development of with Tony. It was a shame Tony left, but he didn't really want to do multi-keyboards, you know, and he stuck to his guns in doing that. And I love him much. But basically, we were definitely looking for anybody who could play multi-keyboards. Yes, needed that. You know, we needed the orchestral side, and we needed all the keyboards that came with, you know, organ, piano, electric piano, you know, whatever have you, harpsichord, you know. So we needed that, but also, you know, we needed somebody who was thinking, you know, about the future and the development of Mini Moog, you know, the Mellotron and all the other gadgety sort of keyboards that came out in the second half of the 70s were really exciting. And, you know, I've got more involved in keyboards myself recently. And basically, it's a wonderful tool. You know, it's a wonderful, wonderful way of making music. So, yeah, right then we did need somebody who had the precision and wanted to, you know, this. I mean, yes, it's a thing like, you know, do you want a break? You know, do you want to get in here and make it better? And that was the approach we had, you know, when Alan joined and when Rick joined. And then Patrick Moraz, who was also pretty amazing, what he contributed. And then Rick came back, and then Jeff Downs came in. So, I mean, the keyboard position is really a big demand. You know, it's a very high demand job.
How was it going into the 80s, though, Steve? Right. Having Trevor Horn now as the lead singer for the Drama album. Did you feel that actually were you nervous about becoming more commercial? Obviously, you become more commercial with Asia. Christ, I mean, you had the biggest selling album in America in 1980, yeah. Whatever it was.
But the Drama thing was just amazing. I mean, it was totally amazing. I loved all of that, because what happened was Chris Allen and I were rehearsing after the Tomato, you know, period had ended. And we kept not having anybody else in the room. So we suddenly realized.
But John, you know, has left, right?
Well, no, he hadn't officially, or maybe even Rick hadn't left, but they weren't there. And in reality, you know, for a few weeks, you start to realise they're not here and we'll just get on with this. So we started writing Tempest Fugia and this other stuff. And then Chris says to me, what do you think about Video Killed the Radio Star? So I said, yeah, but like, wow. He said, but that band got a great album. So I listened to it. In fact, I listened to it on quad electrostatic speakers. And I listened to this and I'm going, oh my God, this is amazing. Listen to this band. And I went to Chris. I said, you're totally right. I mean, these guys would be amazing, you know, and they came and they joined. And we did Drama. And Machine Messiah is now one of the live most exciting tracks that we can play. It's really seriously exciting and electrifying. And I don't really know why, but we love that album. We've done it as an album series as well. So, yeah, the Drama was really something. It brought Trevor and I much, much closer, you know, and, you know, of course, he loved Chris dearly and admired Chris for all his work, because, you know, Trevor's a bass player.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, but Trevor's skills, you know, as a songwriter were starting to really shine, you know, and, you know, they'd already proven, you know, done the Buggles album, you know, The Age of Plastic is not a pop album, you know, I mean, that's a pop song. And a bit like, you know, Atlantic editing Roundabout and making it a chart success to help Yes go forwards with Fragile. You know, we weren't thinking like that. You know, that's what the Buggles had. They had pop success. But there again, Yes didn't want that. We weren't going to do that. We weren't going to go on stage and play Video Killed the Radio Star, because Trevor and Jeff knew that wouldn't work.
Yeah.
It's quite.
But then there's a lovely repaying of the compliment when Trevor gets you in to play on the Frankie Goes to Hollywood.
Well, that's right. I'm really, you know, happy to say, you know, Trevor and I stayed in touch, and basically I popped in on a lot of things, you know, that happened, given it a try, you know, and been part of things that, you know, I've learned more about because of it, you know.
And how did you feel when you weren't there anymore and Trevor comes in and produces what becomes one of the biggest songs that Yes ever made? Did you feel, I mean, listen, you've got nothing to complain about because you've joined Asia, right? And Asia are huge.
You're not sitting in your bed sit with your press cuttings for company. I mean, that's fine.
I mean, utterly huge. I mean, with commercial hits, and then you've got it's amazing, isn't it, Guy? When you think about it, you've got the guy from Yes, the guy from ELP, the guy from King Crimson. They get together and make the most commercial rock album you could imagine. Yeah.
I think all of us wanted a big change. I mean, because, our dad had 10 years. In fact, there was a moment where, I won't tell you the whole story, but Trevor and Chris and Alan had just left my house, and Jeff and I are sitting there, we're going, seems like we haven't got any other guys in the band. We're the only guys left. And I said to Jeff right then and there, I said, look, everything's been so much for 10 years. I don't want to attempt to re-slot another Yes. So, and then I just left that. I don't leave that. And before long, I met John Wetton and then Carl. And then I suggested Jeff Downes joined, us. And that's what made Asia a complete unit, because we had the, thumping keyboards and everything else happening. Thumping drums.
Yeah, absolutely. what's Yes about to do now, Steve?
Well, what we're about to do is going to be rehearsing for European, UK, Japanese tour that goes from the end of April. It trickles along through May. We come to UK towards the end of May. We play the Albert Hall. I think it's on the 3rd of June, I think it is.
Wow.
And
we're going in just a little bit after you.
Yeah, we're in after you.
4th of June. Hope you're not on the 4th, mate, because you're there too. Great. Well, we're there on the Tuesday, the 4th of June, and that's where we end that part of the show. Then we go to Japan in September.
Lucky you.
Yeah, Japan's a nice country to play.
And you don't get tired touring, Steve. It's all, you like the energy still?
Well, I wouldn't say it's not tiring. No, I'll never say it's not tiring. It is tiring. But I've still got the energy for it. I've enjoyed in some way the way it's shifted from, 2019, we were in a roll. In fact, we were in such a roll in 2019, we had half the year off because we'd worked for half the year. And then we said, can't do any more. I mean, we just worked. What do we need to do? Nothing. Let's have it off. But then we didn't know what was in store. A couple of years off from touring meant we could just record, really great. I love to make records, and we made The Quest, and just recently Mirror to the Sky.
Mirror to the Sky, which got us up, which I love, which is great.
So, again, Roger Dean, Forte, everything's happening. So this tour leg is going to be, it's called something like the Tales of Yes Tour. And that's because we're just looping around from 73 being a bit of an anniversary with Topographic Oceans. So we're not playing all of Topographic Oceans, but we play something about it, if you put it mildly.
I love Topographic Oceans. I got it for Christmas, right? In fact, I think I got Topographic Oceans for one Christmas. I think I got Relayer for the next Christmas. But I remember Topographic Oceans, I put it on in the morning at Christmas while we're doing, Mum's preparing the dinner and everything. I think I got a side four and Mum said, could you take that off? It's ruining our Christmas.
Amazing. Yeah, and side two was the great unplayed. We're playing some of side two, but the side two was the great unplayed side because so long we didn't play that. And we like to revisit that, but we put a set list together. We kick it around. It's got songs we like on it, and that's what it's called, the Tales of Yes Tour.
Fabulous. Thanks so much for coming on.
And Steve, there's one thing I really want to share with you, which is that I had an amazing box tick last year, which is that I got asked to play at the John Wetton tribute. And I played it was Phil Manzanero who put the band together and asked me to play with him and Chris Difford. And on drums, Bill Bruford, who'd been retired. It was the first thing he played for years, having been in retired. It was fantastic. But what's funny was we played Let's Stick Together, which is one of John Wetton's greatest bass lines, even though it's the simplest thing in the world. And it was quite funny because it's such a simple, straight ahead thing. And I run it with all the people who are playing that night. In fact, Chris Difford said at the end of the song, that's the only 4-4 you're going to hear all night.
Yeah, and it was Bill Bruford. He's not renowned for Bill Bruford.
And it was great. I've got it. It was just such a thrill to play with him.
Yeah, I wanted to be there. I'd sent a video for that, and I dearly love John. And even though for many years, you know, we didn't speak because, you know, there was so much distance between us, you know. Mm-hmm. But we really, from 2006 onwards, we just warmed to each other in a way that was really remarkable. And loved John so much.
Sorry, Steve. I wanted to ask you if you ever speak to John Anderson still, because obviously you have a different singer for Yes now, and he's been there a long time. But I wondered if there was ever a, you know, connection between you two.
We're still in touch, and that's all I'll say.
That's good. That's good to know.
Yeah, yeah.
Brilliant.
He's a wonderful guy. But yeah, as we were saying, that it's amazing that Bill played there, and my lips are sealed. But yeah, it's amazing what Bill did, because he did stop playing for over years.
Yeah, long time.
And then he spent 2 years, like, relearning. So, you know, he's a formidable force. As I said to him recently, there's only one guy that plays like Bill. That's Will. He's had a remarkable career, but, you know, he just decided enough was enough, and he's got another kind of way of doing it now, which I'm really pleased.
You don't think he got upset when I asked if he speaks to John Anderson still, do you?
He was so upset.
Really? Does he hate me?
That's why we stopped. You know, we've actually had to pad this out, listeners. We actually only had 3 minutes. We started really well, and then you had to say that.
I know. I didn't know whether I said the wrong thing or not. But, you know, you wondered,
No, but you're quite good at that, Gary. You're quite good at... Because everyone wants to know.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like you're the... Unfortunately, that's... You're the guy...
Well, having been in there. An estranged band myself...
Exactly. I mean, what's it? So let's turn this around. How do you feel when people come up and ask you that?
I think it's an honest question.
Just nothing.
It's nothing. What I didn't ask him is if he supports Arsenal or Tottenham. I couldn't believe that little floating he's doing between Highbury and between Holloway Road and Tottenham. But there you go. I thought it was great to have on, and you know, such a man who is so keen about the music still.
Yeah. Yeah,
you want a wee, don't you?
I'm dying for a wee.
You need a wee. See, that's the trouble with long podcasts when you're old. maybe our listeners, our listeners can have a wee while they're listening, can't they? You can't have a wee while you're recording, or are you?
Is there some sort of commode
you're sitting on? All right, so we'll see you all next week. You'll hear us next week. We'll have someone brilliant on. Hopefully, I know we have. We'll have someone brilliant.
Oh, yeah, no, it's a good one next week. Well, it's always good. It's always good,
isn't it? Until then,
it's good night from me.
It's good night from all of us.
Rock on Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.